Hello and welcome to the Armenian News Network Grung Weekend Review. I'm Asbet Bedrosyan, and along with Hovik Manucharyan, this week we're going to talk about the following major topics: the escalation in Yerask, peace treaty at gunpoint, emigration out of Armenia, and a trip report from Harant and Varujan. To talk about these issues, we have with us Varujan Gheghamyan, who is an assistant professor at Yerevan State University and teaches on Turkey's modern history and the history of Azerbaijan. And we also have Harant Mikaelian, who is a political scientist and multidisciplinary researcher in social sciences at the Caucasus Institute based in Yerevan. This episode was recorded on Monday, July 26, 2021. Hello and welcome, gentlemen.
Hello, Harant. Hello, Varujan.
Hello.
Hello to all of you.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. Okay, last week when the border instability around Yerask started and were heating up, Aliyev went to Moscow for a one-on-one meeting with Putin. The message that we read right before, during, and after that meeting from the three OSCE MG co-chairs was that a lasting and comprehensive peace must be hammered out. Aliyev returned to Baku and said that he had already solved the Artsakh issue and that other paths to peace would be wrong and risky. The news reported that Putin had told Aliyev to seek compromise solutions, and Pashinyan rejected that the Artsakh issue is resolved. And a quick note, after Aliyev returned from Moscow, the border shootings stopped pretty soon after that. Varujan, maybe you can tell us a little bit about what you think is going on under this, these situations.
Well, if we try to summarize in one sentence, this is a tough negotiation process, which includes not only one country or three countries, Russia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan, but a huge number of stakeholders, the regional ones and those who are participating in the regional affairs. So Aliyev's trip to Moscow is in frames. I suggest to discuss in frames of this negotiation process. Actually, we have seen the same process by Armenian side as well. The only difference is that Pashinyan visited Moscow, if I'm not mistaken, a month ago, right before the elections, and Aliyev visited right now. But if we look at the official announcement, we can see that Pashinyan is highly connected, let's say, to Kremlin, and in 10 days, two or three times he has telephone calls with Putin. So this is a tough negotiation process. We can see that border escalations are part of this negotiation process, definitely. Azerbaijani side is often repeats the same thesis that Artsakh issue is now closed and it is solved, which means that it's not right now, because when you repeat something very often trying to impose on others your understanding, it means that the other side or others, they don't see the situation the same way. So as I said, this is a negotiation in general.
Interesting. Harant, what is your assessment of what's going on around Yerask and also the underlying theme coming from the Minsk group co-chairs?
I think there is an ongoing negotiation process between France and Russia right now, which might be interesting in its outcomes for Armenia. For example, if there will be a Security Council resolution on Nagorno-Karabakh conflict, that could be a good chance for Armenia. Another good possibility is if France backs Russia's representation in Nagorno-Karabakh, because as of now, Azerbaijan did not grant Russia's peacekeepers with mandate on its territory. So it's a kind of fluid situation yet.
Yeah, what does that mean, by the way?
Azerbaijan tries to trade and to sell it off to Russians in other concessions, at least in Armenian dimension. And concerning the situation in Yerask, Azerbaijan again is trying to, first of all, to check how far it can go. And it turned out that in Yerask they can go much less than in other places, especially in Syunik. The places where you have old border are much more fortified, and for Azerbaijan it's higher to advance there. Another thing is that Azerbaijan tries to insist on peace deal with Armenia, peace agreement, full peace agreement, in frame of which Azerbaijan will try to, first of all, legalize the aggressive war which took place almost a year ago, then to legalize new borders, and then to get more concessions on border in Tavush region. And as of now, Armenian government is rejecting this deal. We have to observe situation more because as of now, it's not very high season for politics. But I would follow the situation more to understand what's going on.
Varujan, you talked about Aliyev's rhetoric and how he's essentially trying to push his points of view very strongly down the throats of the international community and Armenians. I wanted to ask both you and Herant about Pashinyan's rhetoric as well. For instance, something struck me very odd that when, you know, there were already shootouts occurring on the border, Nikol Pashinyan cited unofficial sources as saying, you know, something like, you know, we know from unofficial sources that Azerbaijan is trying to provoke another conflict or another aggravation of the conflict. Is there any, you know, reason to be so careful about phrasing these things? And would it be more helpful if the Armenian side was more frank about what's going on? It seems like Aliyev is announcing his moves and we're saying unofficial sources.
Well, it's always very difficult to try to comment on the things which are unfortunately coming from the Armenian government right now, because sometimes we used to discuss and we used to analyze everything in the frames of conscience and in the frames of political language, but in many times we see that this is another type or postmodern, let's call it postmodern political language. Frankly, I don't know what Pashinyan means when he says that based on the unofficial sources. It's oxymoron. You can't say, being an official man, you can't base your analytics and your rhetoric on the on unofficial sources. And in this sense, we can't really understand what does it mean, what is unofficial sources. Have you read it on the website, or have you heard about it in the bus or in your own administration? This is very difficult to comment, but if we try to understand the frame, it is that Pashinyan is very right now, he is trying to be very cautious, as gushavor in Armenian sense, and he's each his word, which is not for the internal audience. It is highly prepared. I mean, he is trying to use the words and rhetoric which will not put him in a difficult situation, especially towards Azerbaijan and Turkey. He is not trying to escalate the situation. He is not trying to use militaristic rhetoric at all, by the way. A couple of days ago, he said during the government meeting that Armenia is ready to continue the peace process, which is given by the Jogovurt, the people, the mandate which was for peace is given by the by the people. So this is totally is changing the understanding of the regional processes, and of at least one preliminary thought which is coming to us, it is that he has at least a separate track of negotiations with Azerbaijan and Turkey on peace perspective. So this is one thing that we can clearly understand from this rhetoric, first of all.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
So it appears to me that the West, the US and the EU, were sort of waiting to see the outcome of Armenia's June election results, because since then their diplomacy has activated. The European Commission has now pledged somewhere between 1.6 and 3.1 billion euros for Armenia. This is not small money for Armenia in the coming 5 years. And the US and the EU, particularly France, have pledged to find what they call a lasting and sustainable peace in the region. Frankly, to me, it seems like Russia has suddenly become a little bit of the odd man out at present. Have they been caught off guard and maybe a little bit weak at present in the South Caucasus, Herant?
And before actually Herant answers, Aspet, I would like to just mention that the EU pledge, most of it is for debt. for Armenian debt.
So loans.
A lot of news sources actually present that as grants being offered, but you know, I just wanted to correct that for the record.
Then we yeah, can sort of, like, I mean, there are multiple components to what this whole, yes, let's say, aid could be between 1.6 and 3.1, and what components of each year will become grant or what component will become a loan. We don't know at present. But it's a fairly large commitment to Armenia, I thought.
Concerning this ratio of loan and grant, we don't know the exact numbers for Armenia. We know only overall number, which is provided for Eastern Partnership, which is 17 billion, out of which 2.1 is grant. The rest are guaranteed by the EU, so those are not EU funds provided as a loan. Those are funds provided by different investors, but which are guaranteed and with some better conditions, let's say, financially. And they are provided for developing countries, including Armenia. Mm-hmm. As of now, the preliminary figure, if I'm not mistaken, is 2.6 billion euro.
Right.
Concerning Russia, yes, as of now, Russia has no clear strategy towards region. It tries to maintain its presence, but Russians cannot understand what's objective of Armenian side. They more or less understand what Azeris want, and they have dialogue with Ilham Aliyev, and they can expect what they get from him, and not always in reality, because Ilham Aliyev, generally, he knows how to speak with Russians because he learned in MGIMO, a Russian diplomatic university. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he has his second track strategy, which is more towards Turkey and more towards, let's say, egoistic national interest or even his elite interests. But anyway, that is more understandable for them, while objectives of Armenian side are not, and they cannot, let's say, plan anything with Armenia. That's why they decided to have egoistic strategies themselves. And it's not a strategy. It's only can be called tactics, or even less, operative decisions, because there is really no plan behind. And whenever they try to do something on Armenian side, they decide that they should count only on themselves and do separate movements, which in many cases do not just with Armenian interests. But the problem is that Armenia has to formulate its interests first.
Varujan, what are the calculations that are leading the West to bet on Armenia? It seems to me that they were so inert during the 44-day war. They didn't do much, so Russia was mostly acting with Turkey. But ever since they have activated, since the June elections, they are enabling Armenia, and maybe they are trying to come up with additional communication paths to those mentioned in the November agreement. Did they see things in the November agreement that went against the Western interests?
It's a very, very important question, but first let me clarify that when we say West, we mean sometimes collective West, which has some general understanding of the situation in this region. But in many cases, especially in separate cases, these interests and understandings are very diverse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what I'm trying to say is that in some cases, we need to say that there is a collective West. But in some cases, we need to separate the countries which are parts of this collective West.
I guess when I talk about the West in this context, mostly I mean the United States and the EU, and the EU is primarily fronted by France these days.
This is very important because in frames of EU, France has very unique standing on South Caucasus, and especially on Turkey. But we can say that it is the same for Italy, for example, right
yeah.
now. Let me bring one example. It is absolutely clear that the November 9th declaration, especially the article on the so-called Méry or Sunni corridor, it is not in the frames of interest of France. We can say this based both on non-official talks and negotiations as well as open announcements, for example, by the ambassador of France, Jonathan Lacoute. He made just a couple of days ago, again, another announcement about corridor and how bad thing it is. I can say that the other states of the EU have the same standing on this issue. because France clearly understands that corridor to Turkey and Azerbaijan will bring new problems to its interest in Eastern Mediterranean, in Lebanon, etc. So this is only one example. What is the, I think it is my assumption, what is the main aim of the collective West? It is to take out Russia from South Caucasus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
And fully control South Caucasus. And for this, they are using Turkey, definitely. Turkey is an operator. Now it's very popular to say this word, operator or agent of right. West.
Otherwise, we call them a proxy, I guess.
Yeah, or a proxy, yeah. But in case of Turkey, it is more correct to say probably West's ally in the region. So it is an ally, it's a partner. This is the first reason why West tries to provide a very beautiful image of West and what will happen to Armenia if Armenia choose West instead of Russia. So by these loans, by these interactions, by this very positive rhetoric, this is in a way directed towards the Armenian population. So the Armenian audience here. And we see that it has results. Though during the war, we have a very high number of opinion makers who were appealing to Europe and saying that Christian Europe is silent, nobody is taking care of us. So we have seen the real face of West, of Europe. And this was very popular until the end of the war.
Yes.
Now we see just vice versa. Currently, Russia is very unpopular, and this is an increasing trend, anti-Russian sentiments. And instead, our sentiments are very positive towards West right now. Though, as I said, only like 8 or 9 months ago, the situation was just vice versa. So this works.
Yeah.
Another important thing here, and I will finish, it is that West, in a way, and several members of this collective West, clearly understand that Turkey could be much more stronger if it will take the place of Russia and will be the hegemon of the region of South Caucasus. It will become the real superpower of Middle East, mm-hmm. in case it really fully controls the South Caucasus. So it will be the main major actor which will control Middle East, Southern Russia, which consists of Northern Caucasus, a problematic region. It will control also the main gates to Central Asia, etc. And of course, West understands that in case of Erdogan and in case of Turkey, this will become a headache for them. So they are trying also to counterbalance Turkey, using Turkey to take out Russia from the region. So this is a very hard game and very complex relations, and it's unclear which part and which side will be in the end the gaining one.
So when we say the West, we're actually talking about Turkey as an operator taking over in the region.
Yeah, mm-hmm. In my understanding.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would like to add that Turkey was usually, often, and maybe always, was the main operator of West in the region.
Of course.
It always has the same position.
Well, they don't yet have another way in. I mean, Iran is sort of a closed block right now, and until they make full peace with Iran and open it up, there's no other way for them to exert power into the South Caucasus except through Turkey.
Yeah, yeah. And here we see that, for example, in case of even Iran, and that there are some sentiments towards, positive sentiments towards Iran right now. And this is why that even the U.S. hasn't any clear position towards the Turkish corridor through Sunik, but it clearly supports the idea of North-South corridor, which connects Iran to Europe. And we see that some parts of these loans will be given to the development of this north-south route, which is directed towards Iran, not to Turkey, for example. And this is another difference between the West's interest and Turkey's interest.
So, okay, the Armenian-Azerbaijan narrative has shifted from Armenian POWs, who we seem to have, at least in the media, we don't talk about as much now, to the roaming border instabilities, and most recently into the shelling around the village of Yerask, just north of the Nakhichevan border. And this seems to be a strategy from Azerbaijan to keep Armenia under a sort of a state-sponsored terror on the borders and keep the fear of the war restarting alive. And in order to force, it seems, Armenia into more concessions or into even a peace treaty at gunpoint. But as we discussed above, regional diplomacy seems to be aligning against a premature so-called like peace treaty that forces countries into a winner and loser slot, and specifically to predetermine the status of Artsakh. In that context, what are Aliyev's options in terms of negotiating strategy or in terms of next move?
Aliyev tries to succeed on several fields simultaneously. First is diplomacy. And he does a lot of effort in Russia's direction and, of course, Turkish direction. But simultaneously, he tries to use all his possible resources to advance in EU and United States as well. And now they are going to have in Shushi kind of meeting joint with Pakistan, Turkey and Azerbaijan. So first track is diplomacy, then it's general soft power, which they use in many fields and in many dimensions, which they project not only to this region, but also, as we found out, to Armenian diaspora of south of Russia, of, let's say, North Caucasus. And not only, so that's general soft power, including, for example, recent information attacks on Armenian cultural heritage. They also insist that Armenia is attacking Azerbaijani cultural heritage and so on, and simultaneously they destroyed Armenian cultural monuments and tried to present the situation as it was like this all the time. And the third is military attack, which has several goals. One of the goals is to switch the attention of Armenia from Artsakh to Syunik, from Syunik to Gheorghiu-Nik, from Gheorghiu-Nik to Ararat, and so on. And they try to use the time when Armenia is not able to reply, to answer, and they try to not lose the moment, because in several months, or more likely in several years, Armenia will be more capable to reply, and the situation might return to the point when Azerbaijan could not advance without a war. Second is insisting of on getting some territories on the borderline, including Tigranashen, in Ararat region, including several villages and territories on Tavush border, and so on. Third is clear aggressive movement towards Syunik. And generally, there is a trend of Azerbaijan to try to capture Syunik completely or partially. The minimum goal would be having a corridor, which corridor as of now has not very good, let's say, view in eyes of France, of Georgia and Iran. And the program maximum would be to have whole Syunik or partially Syunik under Azerbaijan's military control. And also they are preparing some administrative division to that. We could see that they have created Eastern Syunik Economic Zone, or as they call it, Eastern Zangezur, and other things. So they are pushing towards Syunik. They are trying to, let's say, have direct connection towards Nakhichevan, which is obvious, because after Artsakh, the next goal would be Syunik. And another one is to, let's say, create a constant pressure on Armenia, as you called it, terrorizing Armenia, and let's say make people afraid, disorganize state bodies, especially now as they are not capable to answer, to do anything, and now it is even easier to disorganize state bodies. So, and also Azerbaijan is proposing some plans, like, for example, Hong Kong plan, like Artsakh should pass to Azerbaijan in several decades, like Hong Kong to China. Then they have demands on economy. For example, those companies which have exploited natural resources in Artsakh, they are trying to get money out of it, right, and so on. So they have, let's say, total pressure on many, many dimensions on Armenian side. And unfortunately, Armenia is not capable to do anything as of now.
Well, is Turkey fully aligned with all these things that Azerbaijan is doing? Because if the West, just like we discussed a little earlier, if the West is operating through Turkey, That seems to be a little bit orthogonal to what Azerbaijan is doing right now.
In my opinion, in the West, UK has very clear strategy in South Caucasus, which is alignment with Turkey.
And Azerbaijan.
Yeah, and Azerbaijan as well. And not only, yeah. And for example, Poland, Hungary, Ukraine and so on. Now, EU, continental EU, especially France, has completely different view of region. And US had more or less clear, more or less similar to UK's vision before last several months. And now US is revisiting its strategy, but has not finished the process yet. So we cannot assess the long-term or even midterm US strategy after this revision. So US yet does not have any strategy. So at the moment, I think we have, let's say, three different Wests, which one is all time ongoing, like UK and another, and France as well. And then US is not clear as of now.
Right.
Now, concerning Turkey, Russia is trying to play the same game with Turkey as the West. It's trying to cut Turkey from the West, which does not work much, but it still tries, and it does a lot of negotiation on various fields. Unfortunately, it also works in South Caucasus, and now Russia was effective to decrease Turkey's influence over this conflict, and now Russia has a lot of negotiations with Armenia, with Azerbaijan, but Turkey is only talking with Azerbaijan and does not have any direct involvement in negotiation process. And there is also a possibility that Minsk group will be recovered. It's only possibility, but it depends on Russia-France negotiations. And also it highly depends on Yerevan, because Yerevan could have been the mediator in these negotiations. But it also depends on how capable Yerevan would be there, I think. So, in my view,
for the moment, it seems like the co-chairs are aligned. At least their messaging is cohesive.
Yeah, more or less, we see a process of recovery of Minsk group, let's say. It's a process, but yet it's in an early stage, let's say. And in my opinion, well, generally, I agree with what have been said by all speakers. But in my view, there are many unknowns right now. Maybe by September it will be more clear, but also until September we should be following very carefully what's going on in Sunik and in negotiations between Pashinyan and his Azerbaijani counterpart Aliyev.
Okay. Varujan, do you see any cracks between Turkey's and Azerbaijan's strategies in what's going on right now?
It's difficult to say about the cracks, but one thing is clear, that there is a clear try by Aliyev not to be fully under Turkey, not to fall fully under Turkey's influence. We have very limited information about the internal politics in Azerbaijan, but what we can get from different sources, open sources, is that there is a process started during the war, which resulted in decrease of, let me call them, pro-Russian or pro-Soviet leaders in the Azerbaijani elite. So those who were not fully pro-Turkish, who were trying to keep Azerbaijan's balance between Russia and Turkey, the amount of these people in the ruling elite is decreasing. So
many of them were sidelined during the war.
Yeah, definitely. And this could be a clear sign of Turkish interference also in the Azerbaijani elite, with the aim to take the country, to take the state under full control. So we can see that Aliyev is trying to stop this process or somehow to counter the process. And as Eran told, for now it is difficult to say how it will finish, how this battle will finish. But this definitely influenced the negotiation process also on Armenian issues, because in some cases Azerbaijan could be much more ready to deal with Russia and or through Russia with Armenia than through Turkey with Armenia. So this brings another layer into this whole Middle Eastern game.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Before we go to our final topic, I wanted to quickly mention something that is, being manipulated a lot recently, which is a topic of emigration out of Armenia. Harant, you have a pretty good handle on statistics and numbers, and recently you did an interview with News AM where you stated that around 138,000 people have left Armenia in the first half of this year, and 80,000 of them will probably never return to Armenia. That seems like a pretty worrying statistic. I wanted to see if you could talk a little bit more about that and tell us the basis for this. And, you know, while many of us fear this sort of brain drain and emigration, I'm wondering what tools we have sort of to address that now, and how you see the dynamic developing in the future.
Let me put the general context, long-term context, let's say. Since the day of independence of Armenia, there were only 6 years when Armenia had a positive net movement through border. So it was 2004 to 2006 and 2018 to 2020, out of which 2018 and 2019 were motivated by, let's say, emotional wave and some economic advance, which has started since 2017. And 2020 was caused by technical COVID reasons, by closed borders, and some of Armenia's citizens which had to go back to Armenia from the countries where they were staying. So now there is, first of all, there is a wave of migrants going back. First of all, those who came to Armenia last 3 years. And second, it is that many people have no vision of Armenian future, and they are afraid of Armenian future, and also they are afraid of new war, and some of them are even taking their kids away, especially male kids. So through aviation, we see minus 138,000 people, net balance of passenger flow. We don't have yet data on whole movement, which we will have only in 10 days.
So just to clarify, this is only for the first 6 months of the year?
Yeah, definitely. And every year we used to have about 50,000 of people who were going to Russia for seasonal work and then go back to Armenia. So I assume that some 50,000 of these people will come back, and some 10,000 came back through different, transport means, for example, by bus. There is 80,000 people more, which can be assumed that they will not come back. Of course, many things depend on how economy and general security situation will develop, but yet people don't have many signs of optimism. Although we see some recovery on estate market, but still the security situation did not improve. So I assume that that we might see big out migration wave this year, and it might be even the biggest since 1994. Most probably it will.
Okay, right now let's move to our last topic, which is basically we have been tracking Harant and Varujan, who went on a trip to Russia and Artsakh. So let's hear about that. Varujan, I think you mentioned a little earlier before we started recording that you were recently in Russia visiting many major cities and meeting Armenian community leaders. You also held meetings with Russia's political analyst and academic community. Can you tell us some of the major outcomes in your mind from these meetings?
Yes, sure. First, I would like to mention that we were being invited by the Armenian communities of Russia. And this is first result even before going to Russia, that there is a huge information vacuum and analytical vacuum in general Armenian world. So Russia is not an exception, and people tries to understand by their own what's going on and what kind of future awaits both to Armenia and Armenians in general. So they are trying to find those information centers or those people who can help them understand this. And in this sense, we were glad that some members of Russian, of some Armenian Russian communities found out our non-governmental organization, Armenian Project, Haykakan Nakhagits, and they invited us to talk in person, face-to-face, and to present them the situation. So this was, in a way, a series of lectures in different Armenian communities about the current situation, what happened, what is right now, and what to wait.
Did you find our communities highly engaged with what's going on in Armenia?
We can say that there is still a very huge interest, a very big interest to what's going on in Armenia, but there is another trend, which is a bad trend, that I can say that probably this is present in not only in Russia, but probably in all over the world, in every Armenian diaspora community. People, after the defeat, after the capitulation, and especially after the 20th of June, those who see that the challenges which we are right now facing are not being really articulated to the population by the government, and this lead to disappointment, to even though there are people or there are parts of Armenian communities that are not trying to be associated with Armenia or Armenian topics, and they are desperate. So this is a trend which we call a crisis of identity, because it, in a way, it's a part of the crisis of identity in general. So this is what we have seen in many places. People are, and sometimes we see that those who are desperate are the people who has most abilities, who were most engaged in the community life and has still resources to help to Armenians and to help to Armenia. So this is a bad thing and bad trend, which we should really acknowledge and try to somehow to stop it. Other results are that we can say that people sometimes really don't understand or can't really find any source of information to understand what's going on in Armenia, because there, as people in Armenian villages and in Armenian marzes, can't really understand what happened in Artsakh and what is right now going on with Azerbaijan. The same situation, much worse in many senses, is present in Armenian diaspora. So this clearly shows us that there is a huge need of this kind of project like your Krung podcast. People should know, should try to find this kind of information, sources of information. Herant maybe will, yeah, will continue, I guess.
Yeah, what kind of meetings did you and Herant have with Russia's political circles?
We had a meeting in MMO Institute, which is Institute of International Relations and World Economy. There were people who are dealing with Turkey, with post-Soviet space, and not only. It was rather a representative group of experts of the institute. And they were presenting their position on situation in the region. And we have presented our vision as well. We found out, well, generally we knew that there are many things which Russian counterparts don't know about Armenia and about Armenian position, about Armenian interests. And it's a big fail that Armenian representatives were not able to share these details, to present Armenian view on things and present objective view on things as well, because what experts usually deal is also an information in the field, and which is in most cases it is politicized, and especially if we count that Azerbaijan's spending a lot on lobbying, on buying journalists and so on.
In Russia,
so
right?
In Russia particularly, but not only there, we have seen caviar diplomacy and so on. So, so generally Azerbaijan is trying to find the model which is working in this or that country, and they apply it. And they know how to deal with Russia as well. So we have told some things which were new to our counterparts. And I think we agreed on many things. I think they understood Armenia better. And I think they understood that Armenia and Russia have more in common. And ultimately, they even said that they feel that Russia has lost in this war as well as Armenia.
Yes.
So,
and that's a very important angle because, you know, we have talked in the past and we've been surprised at how inert Russia is, and it's not in the interest of Russia for Armenia to lose like this.
Yeah, but this view is not popular in Russia itself, because Russia is usually trying to find, let's say, they are trying to see the things in a better way for themselves, like most of the countries do.
Yes.
But this time they knew that it's not going good, but they did not find any good way out. Now, it is important that Russia and Armenia, if they wish, they should try to find some kind of strategy where both countries' interests will be respected. It's not only concerning Russia and Armenia, but particularly in this case, these two countries. So I think we were successful in doing so, and I think we should do the same in many other directions, including US, including Middle East, and we have such plans.
Harant, did you find community leaders, Russian-Armenian community leaders, to be engaged with the political circles? Is there dialogue between Armenians in Russia and the ruling elite?
Well, some of them are, but it's very limited space.
Hmm.
From what I have observed, Azerbaijanis as of now have much bigger potential in that. If let's say 15 years ago Armenians were much more influential in Russia than Azerbaijanis, now situation is completely opposite.
It seems to be that there is a lot of similarities with the US, where a lot of the activism and information sort of spreading is done by the Armenian community. But there have been actually calls for Armenia to establish more of a lobbying type of organization and actually put some hard money into, changing opinions or at least getting the information to policymakers. Do you see that also in Russia? And more specifically, how do we change this dynamic long term?
If I may, to continue what Harant just told, sometimes, and Hovik, sometimes it's not matter of money and not matter of big money even. It is a matter of organizational efforts. Once we had the diaspora of Minister of Diaspora, which was at least a first step towards this kind of organizational work, of course with many limitations, but still there was an understanding that we need to do something like that, though no clear understanding what we need, but the direction of thought was correct. Now, as you know, we have no such organization. I don't even count the Office of Diaspora High Representative or something like that as a serious organization to work with diaspora at all. So this is and by the way, if we are going to compete with Azerbaijan and Turkey, we definitely need to compete with them. In diasporas, we formulated that the frontiers of Armenia, they start in diaspora, not in Armenian, not at the front line here in Armenia.
Yeah,
so if we need to compete with them, we don't need to compete with money and this kind of or financial resources. Definitely we'll lose. We need to do much smarter work. This is the only way that we can counterbalance them. Do we have possibilities there? Yeah, definitely we have. In the Middle East, in Russia, in Europe, in many countries, even just the simple image of Armenia and Armenians are much better than those of Turks and Azerbaijanis. Mm-hmm. And this is a very important resource. We should not take this for granted. But we usually do. We think that in Middle East, attitude towards Armenians should be like that. No, and it is changing. I've been in Jordan a couple of months ago as a part of state delegation. And I remember what Armenians Armenians in Jordan first as their main problem they mounted. They said that, you know, we have a problem with publishing articles in state-run resources, online resources, about the participation of Armenians in the Arab resistance back in 1918 against the Ottoman Empire, which is an base for one of the bases or one of the pillars of Armenian Arab and Armenian Islam cooperation. But now they have problems with publishing articles in Jordan. And I said, why? And they said, because of Turks and Azerbaijanis. They work hard to limit our presentation, our presence, our image, our positive image in these countries. And this is a clearly an organized, systematic work against us and towards the increasing of the image of Azerbaijan and Turkey.
Yes.
So we have really need of this. And I would like to add one more thing that we usually think about the foreign relations, bilateral, multilateral relations, that they should be done only by those who has official accreditation, I mean ambassadors, consuls, and official statesmen. No, actually, the main work of the diplomacy is done well before ambassadors arrive. And this should be done right now on many tracks. One of them is the track that we are trying to fill in and to step in. It is the 1.5 and track 2 diplomacy.
Work with
the expert communities, work with the those who are opinion makers in Russia, in the Middle East, in the US. We need to work on this, and then the state will have much less job to do through diplomatic, official diplomatic channels. And this is very important to do right now, especially when state is, let's put it this way, busy with other stuff.
This is very important work, just as you mentioned. Hrant, can you talk just a little bit about your visit to Artsakh and, you know, what outcomes you see from your discussions in that community and our leaders there?
Yeah, of course. First of all, I want to add one small point to what Varujan said. Of course, I agree with what Varujan said, but one more point. It's important to understand that Armenia is a political actor, while diaspora is not. And also Armenia has one organizational center, while diaspora has not. So Armenia has to do a lot of effort also to, let's say, help diaspora organize and to be more connected within itself as well.
Yeah, to coordinate, and, essentially.
Yeah. And Armenia can do that, theoretically, of course. Now, concerning Artsakh, what I have seen in Artsakh is that besides of what we know from news and from data and so on, is that Artsakh is living more or less home life. It's this time it was even more like Republic of Armenia than ever before. So all the time I have been visiting Artsakh like for 14 to 15 years, and every time I would arrive to Artsakh I would see more and more similarities with Armenia, and now I think integration came to its highest, and there are even concerns that it might go down after all what happened. But anyway, as of now, Stepanakert is like small Yerevan, 20 times smaller, but still the same. And same refers to other territories generally as well. And
is there a major issue with IDPs in Stepanakert?
There is such issue, but it's not like like you see them everywhere. They found a way to, let's say, to give them some place. Not all of them. They say it's already 115,000 inhabitants in Artsakh. Sometimes they even cite 120,000. It's a bit suspicious, although I cannot deny the number. I can just quote it. I think 100,000 is there for sure. But if there is really 115,000 people there, I think it's not a bad result. And they bet for achieving like 130,000. They understand that they need to resettle people who left villages to, let's say, some kind of rural area again. And they don't have enough resources, but also they have good expectations from foreign aid and, of course, aid from Republic of Armenia. They have more budgetary incomes than they would expect, after all, but, of course, twice less than they had an year ago.
Mm-hmm.
Social activity, as I saw, has not recovered, of course. It has decreased like by maybe 40% compared to pre-war situation. But given that Karabakh was very active, it's not that bad. It's still better, let's say, for example, Stepanakert is looking still better than Vanadzor. Some buildings which have been affected by bombarding have been recovered, but Stepanakert was not as heavy bombarded generally. So there were several acts of bombardment, but not so much. And ultimately, people are expecting a lot from international community and from Armenia. They don't know what their future exactly will be, but they hope that both Russia and France will do something. That's, let's say, general view.
Is it easy for you as a citizen of Armenia to travel to Artsakh?
More or less, yes. I can go there. There are several checkpoints. They don't stop you much, I think. They don't even check everyone, and they don't check, let's say, whatever you carry.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they might, but not all the time. And so generally understanding where you are going and which situation is there, the trip is safe. And also it's important that most of checkpoints, Russian checkpoints, I mean, are located in, let's say, territories where Azeris are active and where Azeris are trying to get control or have even got control during the war, like Lysagor or around Shushi.
Mm-hmm.
So it's also a technical mean. And also in Artsakh, while traveling, you don't see the border very clearly.
Mm-hmm.
So you should know where it is. You don't see it on the ground.
All right. Well, we look forward to talking with you gentlemen in a couple of weeks after your upcoming trip. All the best of luck to you, and talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Hrant. Thank you, Varujan.
Thank you, everyone.
That concludes our program for this Week in Review episode. We hope it has helped your understanding of some of the issues from the previous week. We look forward to your feedback and your suggestions for issues to cover in greater depth. Contact us on our website at grung.org or on our Facebook page, ANN-Grung, or in our Facebook group, Grung-Armenian News Network. Special thanks to Laura Osborne for providing the music for our podcast. On behalf of everyone in this episode, we wish you a good week. Don't forget to subscribe to our channels, like our pages, and follow us on social media. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.